Look at this place. You are looking live. We are in China, and it's amazing to with. It's just an amazing sight to look. You see this? In fact, we've got some images I want to share with you right now as we begin this historic newscast that we're bringing to you today from China. See that building right there? That's the building that we're in right now. It's called the Han Palace. It's some 600 years old, dates back to the Ming Dynasty. The building, that is, though most of the furnishings that you see in there, for those of you who are true historians and know about these types of things, you'll recognize it's mostly from the Qing Dynasty. Actually, some of the furniture that's been used by emperors in the past. So it's interesting that we would find ourselves in a place like this on this day. This is, without question, one of the most historic and transformational moments for any journalist outlet to be able to cover, especially given the number of people who are here, the decisions that are being made that could very well affect the direction of the world itself. That's why we're doing this. There's so much to say. So much is happening with so many leaders that are saying so many important things. And that's what we're going to be taking you through right now. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Every once in a while, there is a news event that transcends just whatever it is that we tend to think of what news is, and it goes beyond that. And in this case, what we're actually seeing is what may be a transformational historic moment, not something that suits the 24-hour news cycle. No, something that historians will eventually look back on and say, that's where the world changed. That's where the world changed. That's when we went from this epic or from this era into the beginning of another epic or another era. And that seems to be what is happening right now. And nothing frames that description. Nothing frames that description better than the pictures that I'm about to show you. Take a look at these. Take a look at these images that I'm about to show you right here. These are the presidents of China and Russia and India. There they are, Mr. Putin, Mr. Modi, and Mr. Xi. This is just earlier when they first arrived here and they had this meeting, almost as if to send a message to the world, look at us, look at this union, look at this association that we are creating here. Henceforth, we are to be taken seriously because we represent those three countries with the faces of those three men that you're seeing right there, both from a military standpoint, from a GDP standpoint, from so many different measures, what has become a more powerful union than what used to be the powerful union. When you think of, I mentioned a while ago, the era, the epic. That era, that epic, was essentially symbolic of what most people would call Western hegemony, right? In other words, the big boys, the guys who called the shots were what? The United States and the UK and Germany and France. What is happening right now, what we're seeing develop, and the reason we're here is because that's changing. And one of the things that can truly direct that change is not weaponry or bombs or guns. No, no, no. It's about the economy, stupid. It's always about the money, right? And maybe one of the most important statements that's been made here yet came from Mr. Putin. He just spoke a while ago, and I want you to hear what he says, because he goes right at what they hope will come out of this. Remember, it's not only those three countries that are here. It's countries from all over the world that are here. And what Mr. Putin seems to be suggesting that they need to do at the very top of the agenda is change the economic system so that in the future, these countries don't have to depend on the U.S. or the West for their banking system, for the way that they trade, for their whatever it is that they use for monetization. Here's Mr. Putin addressing that very thing. Let's take a listen.
We advocate for issuing joint government bonds, creating our own payment and accounting infrastructure, and forming a joint investment projects bank. All of these measures will enhance the effectiveness of our economic exchanges and shield them from external pressures. A new system of stability, security, and peaceful development in Eurasia, one that would replace Eurocentric and Euro-Atlantic models. This system would consider the interests of the widest possible range of countries and be truly balanced, ensuring that no single state seeks to secure its safety at the expense of others.
I mean, talk about where the rubber meets the road. He's going right at it. I expected this would be some kind of declaration they would make at the end where they say, and in conclusion, this is what we suggest. But Mr. Putin, I mean, he stepped right into this thing. And it's and I think so far, my opinion, some people may differ. I think it's probably the most significant outlay of ideas or principles or proposals that has been suggested so far. And that's not to say there hasn't been a lot of important things that have happened here. And we're going to take you through those. You're going to hear from Mr. Xi. You're going to hear from Mr. Modi. You're going to hear from Iran. And all those things are very important. But I wanted to start with this because I think it's very important. And it also suits the gentleman who's standing right here or sitting right here to my right. He is Professor Benjamin Chow. He is from the Paris School of Technology. He is an expert in business. He is an expert in globalization. He knows the China model. He's also a PhD from the University of Michigan. So it's really a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Let's get into this. As you can see, I'm like a little kid in a candy store here. I'm watching history unfold, and as a journalist, I'm privileged to be in this situation. I found what Mr. Putin said to be very important, and I think in the end, that's the direction that this body of countries can take that would really affect the Western hegemony. Am I right? Am I wrong? Please explain it to me.
You're absolutely right. Hegemony is fading. We are having a multipolar world already. The U.S. is no longer be able to force actions on other people, especially these people. If they follow the U.S. Coercion, they would suffer quite a lot. Look at the EU, they are almost brain dead. Do they really want to go to the go into this war? I don't think so. They are one of the biggest victims of this.
So the moment where two things happen in our world in the last 3 or 4 years. One is the United States says to Russia, we're going to punish you so hard. We're going to freeze your assets. We're going to sanction you. We're going to castigate you. We're going to tariff you. We're going to do everything possible to destroy your economy and possibly even change your political system. And Russia not only survives, but you could argue in many ways they've thrived. They've done it by finding other markets and said, okay, we won't trade with the West. We'll trade with India. We'll trade with China. Fascinating. That was number one. The second phase of this is when suddenly the United States then says, okay, we've punished Russia, but that didn't work. Now we're going to punish India. And they turn to India and says, if you trade with Russia, we're going to punish you just as much as we punish Russia. And India says, sorry, we're not going to do what you say. We're going to take care of our own people. Those two actions may be the catalysts that bring us to where we are today.
Well, look at India. India has been saying that they are following independent foreign policy. So that's why they are not following the states to sanction Russia, because they together with a lot of other countries, not just the Western powers, but the majority of the world actually are not following to sanction Russia, because they have the right to better the lives of their people. If they don't trade with Russia to buy oil, where could they get those oil from? You know, you give us an alternative, then we can talk. If there's no alternative, then we have to do it.
So what's the alternative? And this is where this gets really interesting. I'm so glad we've gotten to this. So let me bring in President Xi. Here's President Xi. He's the alternative, because he's now going to President Modi and saying, I got your back. Don't worry about the U.S. threatening you. We will do business with you. We will buy whatever refined oil you may have. We will share our rare earth minerals with you. We are going to start opening flights back and forth between China and India, something that wasn't happened before. We will now sit down and make sure we don't have more conflicts in the Himalayan border area. All of these things have happened in the last couple of months
right.
since that threat came from the United States. So here's President Xi.
China and India, two ancient Eastern civilizations, are the world's two most populous countries and important members of the Global South. They shoulder the important responsibility of furthering the interests of their people, promoting the unity and revitalization of developing countries, and advancing the progress of human society. The world is undergoing a century of rapid transformation, and the international landscape is undergoing complex changes. The right choice for both sides should see China and India as good neighborly friends, partners for mutual success, achieving a dance of the dragon and the elephant.
Professor Chow.
Yes.
The dragon and the elephant.
Yeah.
What's he saying?
Well, look, the Trump administration and the U.S. seems to be an easy target to blame for the union of new union of China and India. But there is actually a basic logic to it. I myself a yogi. I practice yoga every day. I speak a little Hindi. So I really love the Indian culture. So I know there is a lot of synergy between the two countries. The two leaders, actually, before the recent Trump action, they already met in the last BRICS meeting, saying that they will put aside the conflict on the border, which is the longest disputed border in the whole world.
That's a big deal.
3,000 kilometers.
Yeah.
They said, okay, let's put aside this. We're going to get to anywhere, but let's work on the economy. We already have this consensus. Because China and India, half of the world's population and half of the world's growth.
But are you saying that the threat used by the United States, held over India's head, did not accelerate or even catalyze what we're seeing now?
It stimulates a little bit, yeah.
It did. It stimulated it.
It did. Because, you know, Trump is always, has these very extreme measures. You always have to have something on the table to bargain with him.
You know what's interesting about this? The West is now saying that they're not embracing these meetings. As a matter of fact, they're being very critical of them. What would have happened if the West would have gotten India to go along with not accepting that Russian oil? I would think from a global standpoint, and I have sources that have told me, the world needs oil. There's not enough of it.
Of course, yes.
And Russia has the most of it. So if you take the country that has the most and say your oil is not going to be used around the world, what you're going to create is a huge shortage. That shortage will cause the price of oil to go up, which could have global consequences. I'm not an economist like you, but am I wrong?
It hurts everybody. It's already shot up the inflation of the United States already. And that might lead to the fall of the Biden administration.
So the idea of trying to sanction with a secondary sanction and tariff on India so that they don't buy Russian oil and then going around telling everybody else not to buy Russian oil could have had, if they could pull it off, could have a devastating effect on the world economy.
Of course, oil is a major commodity. So we cannot live with them. In China, even, we only have several months of reserves. If we don't have oil from outside, we also have a problem, let alone other smaller countries.
So following up on the enthymeme that you and I are creating, and you're so much smarter than I am at making me understand this, I'm thinking if they can't get oil from Russia, which is one of the biggest producers of oil in the world, because some of the most oil in the world, and natural gas, by the way, not just oil, then they would have to take it from only two other places. The Middle East and the United States.
Just look at this, the control experiment in Europe. The least affected country is France because they have nuclear power. Look at Germany and UK. I think an average household in the UK, they spend an extra £50 a week because of the inflated prices of everything.
Yeah. And those economies are in trouble.
Yes.
And from a GDP growth standpoint, they're completely conversely related to the ones that we're seeing in these countries, including India, which has the highest at 6.8. And speaking of India, I think Yeah, I think, let me do this. I want to show you something, because while we're on the subject of Mr. Xi, I come from a country in the West. I'm an American. Okay. You know, you went to the University of Michigan. University of Michigan.
Yes.
When you were in the University of Michigan, people all thought that you came from a communist country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, severely communist country. I don't mean just as a label. I mean that people here are dreary, and there's no freedom of either A, speech, or B, commerce. So I went out last night in Beijing. I wanted, as an American, to get a sense of what it was like here.
Right.
And I did what we like to call a walk and talk.
Okay.
Right, on the streets of Beijing. Yes. Felt very free. A couple of police officers looked at me like, okay, what's this guy doing? But they basically stood aside and allowed me to do my thing. I want to present that now and want you to take a listen to it and tell me where I might be wrong or I may be right. Here it is. See that? That's Huawei. That's one of the biggest telecommunications and IT companies in the entire world. But wait, you want to see something else? There's Apple. Also one of the biggest telecom and communications companies in the entire world. So you got Huawei and you have Apple. And you know what's interesting about this is Huawei represents for China its own domestic ability to compete on a global basis as a business enterprise. One of the biggest companies in the world. But it's not afraid to put Apple across the street and say, you want Apple? There's Apple. You want Huawei? There's Huawei. See, that's the thing. If you try to understand actually what's happening with the business in China, for example. Hi. You have to kind of understand that, you know, in the West, we often refer to this as a so-called communist country. Here we are in the middle of the night. Everybody's out, by the way. And if you were to ask these people, do your own Google research on this. If you were to ask the average Chinese person, do you feel free? Do you feel freer today than you did in the past? By far, people in China today feel more free than they ever did in the past. Now, let's flip it. Go to America right now. And again, don't take my word for this. Do a Google search if you want to. Ask the average American if he feels freer today than he did in the past. It's the opposite. Used to be some 10, 20 years ago, the average American would tell you that 90% of Americans felt freer. Today, it's down to like 70%. So in America, the number's going down. Here in China, while we tend to describe this country as communist and the people who live here as living in a communist regime, the average person who lives here in China doesn't feel that way. You stop right now and you ask people on the street, do you feel free? They go, yeah, my life is basically free. Sure, there are some hardships. They work very, very hard. You know, there's some issues that they have to deal with. But on general terms, they feel like they're able to make a living, like their country is prospering. They are generally in agreement with their government, according to all the polls. And when it comes to what we call the free market, people's ability to start businesses, sell their things, sell their wares, so to speak, it's all here. Look at this. This is a mall you see behind me. You see right there? What does it say? I mean, here's the sign. Look at it. Come with me. There it is, right outside. You're going to see Nike right outside. And behind Nike, if you want to see a little competition, There's Skechers. See? There's Skechers right over there. So what we have right now in this country is something that's really quite interesting. The average person feels freer by comparison than how people feel in the United States. And if you were to judge, let's say we wanted to judge communism, if communism is how much control the state has over our lives, and how much they take away from us, for example. Well, the average person here pays about 20 to 30% taxes. If you're a business person, you have to give back to the government something like 30% of the money you earn in taxes. Meanwhile, in the United States, it's 35, 40,
sometimes more. Even just capital gains for the average rich guy is 28%. And that's before he pays some of his other municipal and state taxes. So who's free? What's free? What's a free country? What is capitalism? What is communism? Where is there a free market? Interesting questions to pose when you come to a place like this. And this is what we've been able to find out as we sit here behind the moniker back there of Apple.
It seems like we grew up in a world where this is the right way, that's the wrong way, these are the good guys, this is the bad guy, this is democracy, this is communism, this is freedom, this is lack of freedom. I think it's all jumbled up these days, and that's the point I was trying to make.
Exactly. We shouldn't really fall into the trap of rhetorics, fall into the trap of polarization, dividing things into black and white. Communism is but one head of China. China is also advanced, pulling 800 million people out of poverty in 40 years. China is very safe. You go to the same spot at 3 a.m., you're still fine.
Yeah.
You cannot do it in the States, I can tell you.
No. We have a lot of homeless. We have a lot of drug addiction problems.
It is.
We have some serious crime issues in the United States that we're dealing with, and we're trying to make it better, but I can't lie. It's a serious problem, and I'm not sure I see a lot of that here.
I go to France as well very often, and every time
there was
a lot of pickpockets, right? But in China, it's diminished. Some of my friends are police chiefs, the officers, they lost their jobs almost because there are no more pickpockets because we have some technologies and
Can I tell you a story?
Yes, yes.
This happened today. See this phone?
Yes.
So today I was at my hotel, staying a very nice hotel, not here, another hotel. And, I have an American phone, and I have a Russian phone, and I have a Chinese phone. I got too many phones.
And you lost it.
So I left it, and then I went jogging. And in the middle of my jog, I thought, oh, my God, I left my phone just sitting there in the middle of the table. Went back, went to the counter. I said, by chance, did somebody turn on your phone? The guy says, of course they did. It's right here.
Exactly. I can tell you, in 5,000 years of Chinese history, right now, this time, this place is the safest.
Safest
time in the last 5,000 years.
Well, here's Modi. Let's go to Modi.
Yes.
Because that's the third part of this, which I think is so important. Modi comes from a country which has had a conflictive relationship with China. Let's face it. Let's not kid ourselves. So it's a big step for him to embrace China, and it's as it is for Mr. Xi to embrace Mr. Modi and India. So here's Mr. Modi now talking about the 28 billion people who will now get the benefit of this relationship. Here's the president of India.
Our cooperation is linked to the interests of 2.8 billion people of our two countries. This will also pave the way for the welfare of all humanity. We are committed to advancing our relations based on mutual trust, respect, and sensitivity. Your Excellency, I congratulate China on its successful presidency of the SCO. Once again, we extend heartfelt gratitude for the invitation to visit China and for our meeting today.
I have been listening to President Modi and the reaction that they're giving him Prime Minister. I have been listening to Prime Minister Modi's statements, but more importantly, I've been reading and watching the reaction that he's getting in the Indian press. They are 100% behind these meetings. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of anticipation and almost a general acceptance in his country for him doing this. Do you see that as well?
You see, I'm almost having tears now seeing all these presidents, prime ministers coming, you know, smiling, shaking hands. You know, because I speak a little Hindi, I know the difficult time that we had in the last 7 years. But finally, we recognize the importance to work together. And you know, China has already trade with the SCO countries in an amount of 2.3 trillion already. So that has to go up with India.
That's interesting. You just said that you almost feel like you're going to break into tears watching this. Does the average Chinese citizen look at this and behold this as a real transformational moment for their country and for the world?
They're all very happy. But if they are really into the academics of it, into ancient Chinese example, for example, they would see that a lot of Chinese actually came from India, Sanskrit. Yeah. They say a lot of, because Buddhism affect the Chinese for so much, actually a lot of our modern day language, like time, space, all this, the word, the vocabulary are from here, Sanskrit.
There's another element that's been thrown into this now, and I wanted to include this because when we think of U.S. hegemony, we always say the West, and we usually are referring to, you know, as you mentioned, Paris and France and the U.K. and Germany and the United States. You know, there's another element to this, and that is Israel. And in the last couple of years, we've seen the power that Israel manifests by engaging the United States.
Right.
It doesn't look good right now, either for Israel or the U.S. because of the situation in Gaza. But there's somebody else who's here. And this is President Pezeshkian, the president of Iran, who also put in his two cents. And I wanted to share that with you. Here's the president of Iran.
The SCO organization comprises member states and partner countries, representing nearly 2.5 billion people. More than 40% of the global economy falls within the SCO framework. Naturally, the organization strives to promote multilateralism in a world where unilateralism and hegemony have taken root in the US and European blocs. The connections we can establish within the region, both among ourselves and with other member countries, can have a significant impact.
What do you think, Professor, of President Pezeshkian's words and his presence here?
Well, since the first presidency of Trump, the U.S. influence in the Middle East has diminished. They're pulling out of the Middle East, but then giving chance for China to go in and so on. But with the second presidency of Trump, he is all in Israel, causing a lot of problems, and it might need the help of Russia and China to balance a bit right now. And Iran is, as you know, because of the recent war over there, it suffers a lot, and now it's no longer a global player in the region, I think.
So one would think, right, let's take this another step forward.
Right.
This is great, this conversation we're having, and I'm learning, and I think millions of people who are watching us now all over the world are probably trying to get a better understanding of this, and they may be learning something about this as well. Because I was thinking, wow, they're going to have this Shanghai summit, cooperative summit, and wouldn't it be interesting if the United States or the UK would send a representative? The UK would send maybe their foreign minister. The United States would send Marco Rubio, a guy I practically grew up with in Miami, that there'd be some kind of embracing, at least, of saying, okay, listen, we respect the fact that you guys are having a meeting. I expected that. No, it's just the opposite. And I'm going to give you two examples of that. First, take a look at this headline. Look at this headline. This headline is basically one that is pushing the rest of the world while this is going on right now, right? Halt all oil and gas imports from New Delhi. White House is pushing Europe to copy the U.S. tariffs on India. They want the rest of the world to punish India for its embracing of China and Russia. It's almost foolhardy, it seems to me, that they would be doing that. Not only are they not embracing this, obviously, to look at that headline, it almost sounds like they're being very antagonistic. And if you thought that was antagonistic, I want you now to listen to the words of Peter Navarro. He's one of the president's trade advisors. And here he is. Look, I don't know if there's another way I can say this. This is a very insulting, stereotypical statement that he's about to make about India and the Indian people. Here it is.
Modi's a great leader. I don't understand why he's getting to bed with Putin and Xi Jinping when he's the biggest democracy in the world. So I would just simply say to the Indian people, please understand what's going on here. You got Brahmins profiteering at the expense of the Indian people. We need that to stop.
He's talking about Indians being bigots. What other, did I read that wrong? He says the Brahmins are taking advantage of the rest of the people and...
Well, we might want to first ask the question, who is the biggest terrorist organization in the whole world? So if you ask the world's population, they would have very interesting answers.
Yeah, yeah. They would look at what's going on in Gaza and they'd say, right.
Anything, you know, people have different views, you know.
Do you think those words do not sound very diplomatic. How is that going to be taken by Mr. Xi and Mr. Putin and Mr. Modi and some of the other leaders who are meeting here?
It really does not affect our mood that much because we have very long-term strategy. You know, we follow our strategy. We don't change as much. This kind of thing is just a very side stories. But as many of these diplomats have said, actually Trump has destroyed diplomacy in the U.S. And some of these, his subordinates, allies, following them, maybe worsening the situation.
Destroyed, you said?
Diplomacy.
Yeah.
Yes.
In other words, if you say destroyed, that means there's no way to come back from it. That means...
the moment, yes.
Well, yes. Doesn't that get us to where we are right now?
Yes.
So the reason we're here, and the reason I've been saying this is a very transformational moment for the world, is... these countries that are here have finally said enough is enough. We're no longer going to try to be friends with you. Everything we do, you turn your back on us, you insult us, you slap us down, and we've tried a million ways. But since that keeps happening, that's fine. You guys be over there, we are going to be over here.
Yes.
That's kind of what I'm hearing. Is that the message that's going to be coming out of here?
You have been saying that Russia is shifting the supply of oil not to Europe, to China and so on. You know, compensating the loss of business, but all in all, you know, it's a lose-lose situation.
Okay,
for everybody.
So let help me explain. You are an expert on globalization. You're a professor of business. So, what exactly will India do now to be able to make do without the support and trade with the United States? How will it now combine with China and Russia and other countries? And is that what's actually being discussed at this symposium, at this summit?
I'm not worried about India. Look, go to Silicon Valley. Look at the chiefs of the high-tech companies. They're all Indians. These are the biggest driver of the American economy. I don't think it's going to have a very bad relation between India and also the United States.
So, let's suppose the actual Indian business person says, but wait a minute, we've got to deal with these tariffs now. Seems to me like Mr. Xi is saying to Mr. Modi, don't worry, we have your back. You're going to be doing business with us now. Whatever the Americans didn't want to buy, we've got so many consumers in China that are going to be able to buy that. So is it really come down to these two countries, these two leaders sitting down and hashing out deals with the rest of the world?
I think even with China's backing, India would still lose because the U.S. is still the largest GDP in terms of nominal GDP. But China is actually the largest since 2014 in terms of purchasing power parity. So China could make up a lot of its business. Look at Russia, for example.
Yeah. So you, if you were advising Mr. Modi, you would have also said to him, no. Don't kowtow to that United States demand. Your people need the oil and the gas, and you should at all costs continue that deal with Russia?
I think it should continue to deal with Russia. But otherwise, it cannot get any oil from other countries because it's such a big population. I think it's to India's interest to play both cards, you know, to be friends both with China and the United States.
What do you say to those who say, Professor, that the situation right now with Ukraine, for example, is one where the West is saying, I'll give you an example.
Right.
There was just a missile in Kiev, and apparently the EU is saying saying that Russia has shot off this missile and they need to be investigated. And obviously, if there's anything wrong with what Russia did, they should be investigated, of course. But the only reason I'm bringing this up is because that same institution, the EU and NATO and the US, has not said the same thing when Ukraine hit a railroad, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They've not said the same thing when Ukraine hit commuters on a bridge in Crimea, for example. So it almost seems like they use every opportunity to blast China, to blast Russia, And if they're doing something wrong, they should be. And when we should look at it, and there should be an investigation. That's what should happen. But it doesn't seem to be, it only seems to be one-sided.
It's classic double standard. When there was this knife wielding event in China, Xinjiang region, some years ago, it was classified by other countries as a terrorist action event, but the CNN reported it as just a knife wielding event.
I'm wondering as we go through this, whether the idea of what a free market really is something that Americans will understand they do not have a monopoly on. Do you think there's, this show reaches people all over the world, and I hear from people every day, hundreds of thousands of people, who are telling me the messaging is getting through, and we are understanding that we do need to live and understand the world from a multipolar standpoint and not from a unipolar standpoint. Do you think that can happen? Do you see it happen with your colleagues that you talk to?
You know, we really believe what we see, you know, as a human being. You know, I think if, you know, yes, for you, for example, you forgot half of what the U.S. major media has been saying about China. Just come to see and feel yourself, feel the safety, you know, try the food, talk to, look at the smiles of the people, and you will completely change from your naked eyes. What you see is important.
So take me through what we expect will happen at the end of this summit. I imagine there's going to be some declarations made. There's going to be some formal agreements made.
Right.
What do you foresee would be the result of this summit?
So these nations have been meeting quite often. The SCO and the BRICS have been many times. But this year is particularly different in that it is the 18th victory anniversary of the victory of the Second World War. Now, it means a lot. My father always showed me his wounds on the legs because of the Japanese invasion. So I feel it personally. Now we have a very long period of peace. It is very precious, but we really can. We really can maintain it. Look at the model of China that is unseen in any period of history, that a major country climbs up to this status without waging any wars, almost.
Yeah.
It's a role model.
By the way, as I was walking around the streets of Beijing, I was looking at many of the people and talking to the taxi drivers.
Yes.
And it seems like they obviously welcome and are happy that their country is prospering and that they feel, as I said, a little more free. But have they caught up to the technology? It seems to me sometimes like they're befuddled by it somewhat.
Look, in Beijing, you could already try delivering your orders by drones. You could also go to a convenience store, and you could pay by scanning your palms.
And that's fine for the young people, but what about the guy who's middle-aged or something?
Even 80-year-old, because of the COVID pandemic, even 80-year-old know how to use their phones now. These adults cannot get around.
Let's talk about something that's very sensitive, and I want your honest opinion.
Okay.
It seems to me that the Taiwan issue is potentially escalatory.
Mm-hmm.
My fear is, just like I watched the United States and the NATO countries doing military exercises in the Black Sea, right off the coast of Russia, and not soon after that, we saw what happened with what some call a provocation.
Right.
Of Russia, which I think is probably correct. How fearful should we be? How concerned should we be that that same type of thing could happen with Taiwan?
You know, Taiwan is really the bottom line of China. You know, don't touch Taiwan if you want to make friends with China. President Xi made it very clear to every president in every country. Militarily, China can easily conquer Taiwan in a few hours. But we don't want to do that because they are all our brothers and sisters. There's no need because if you look at the one country, two system, successful models in Macau and Hong Kong, it looks feasible. And they continue, these two cities continue to enjoy prosperity after coming back to the motherland.
It's interesting. You just said something I hear from Russians and Ukrainians. Ukrainians and Russians feel like they're brothers, cousins, and they've had a shared relationship for 1,000 years.
You know, I have a Russian teacher. She's from Crimea. I told her this morning that I'm in the interview, and she's very happy seeing Putin, President Putin visiting China. Her family adheres more to the Russian side than, you know, traditional Ukrainian side. So history is very complicated.
So the West sees Taiwan, going back to Chiang Kai-shek, as an independent country that should be left alone. China sees it as a province of theirs, like Texas would be for the United States.
Look,
which is
look, really, there's a fundamental difference. Ukraine and also Russia are two sovereign states, right? And Taiwan is already considered by the United Nations and many other countries that it is a part of China. There's no doubt about it. It's whether current administration is another matter, but the sovereignty, there is no question about it.
So, in other words, what following the anthemime that then you're just presenting is, right, if the West were to create a hostile action in Taiwan, China would take it as though you're attacking China.
It is internal. It's internal issues of China. That's the official standpoint of mainland China. And even the United States recognized China as one China. It did not recognize sovereignty of Taiwan, no.
Do you fear that because the United States and the West didn't respect that in Ukraine, they may not respect it in Taiwan? Does that concern you? Should it concern China?
From international, it's a completely different matter. But what the U.S. Has done in Taiwan actually also anger China because they are sending the three in the power line, Pelosi, to Taiwan.
Yeah.
That really angers.
That's provoking.
Yeah, it's provoking.
Let's talk about the thing we started at the very beginning of the show. Mr. Xi mentioned it. I think all the leaders did. And I said it. I think what we're witnessing right now is a historic moment where the world is shifting from one power base into the beginning of another power base, or at the very least, a shared power base. Is that correct?
Of course. Now, the SCO alone constitute half of the world's population and one-fourth of the world's GDP already. So it's not just a beginning of polarization. We are already doing it for one decade, at least. And I think the U.S. and the West has to accept now that it's already a fact that we need to find ways to work together.
Do you think they will?
They have to. They have to, and they are doing it.
But I just played for you the provocation from Mr. Peter Navarro, these headlines.
Even the U.S. government do not necessarily represent the whole U.S. population. I have a lot of American friends, very good.
Of course.
These civilians, they want to do business. You see?
Yeah.
What the U.S. seems to have to focus on their problems. In the last four or five administrations of the government, it's not about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party losing. It's the incumbents.
Yes. Okay.
Incumbent losing. That is, they are losing the heart of the people.
Yeah.
They're not supporting the government. That's the real issue.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing. And that's what we're seeing in those freedom studies that I mentioned while I was out there in Beijing. Professor, what a delight.
Yes,
thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
What a great conversation. It's always so important to get a perspective from someone like you to help us better understand what the thought processes are in a place like this. And we're going to stay here and continue to cover this for you. There's going to be apparently more meetings that are going to be taking place between all of these leaders. And look, we just mentioned a little bit of what's being discussed by some of these leaders. There's leaders here from all over the world that are going to be having meetings, and they too are going to be coming out with their own perspectives. And we're here to let you know what they say as history is being made right here in China. And we're only honored and too happy to be able to bring it to you. I'm Rick Sanchez. This has been The Sanchez Effect, and we'll be looking for you again next time.